content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the March 18th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A bitterly divided GOP heads for a crack-up. What happened? Donald Trump tightened his grip on the Republican nomination with a string of primary and caucus victories this week, giving him a significant momentum going into crucial March 15th contest in Florida and Ohio. The billionaire businessman swept convincing victories in Michigan, Mississippi, and Hawaii on Tuesday, having won Louisiana and Kentucky on Saturday. Texas Senator Ted Cruz confirmed his status as Trump's most formidable rival, winning contests in Idaho, Kansas, and Maine, and finishing second in the other races. Marco Rubio, once the hope of the Republican establishment, endured another dispiriting week. The Florida senator won in Puerto Rico, but finished third or fourth everywhere else. Republican leaders' last hope for denying Trump the nomination came down to this scenario. Rubio wins his delegate-rich home state of Florida. Ohio Governor John Kasich triumphs in his home state, and Trump falls just short of amassing the 1,237 delegates he needs. The nomination would then be decided at an open convention. Trump's victories came despite a renewed effort by Republicans to block his nomination. Mitt Romney, the party's 2012 presidential nominee, made an unprecedented attack on Trump as a phony, a fraud, and a failed businessman, urging voters to back the other candidates in order to deny Trump a delegate majority and force a brokered convention. Some senior Republicans called for a traditional conservative to run a third-party candidate, even if it results in a Democratic victory. In the 11th GOP debate last week, Trump caused even more despair among party leaders by boasting about the size of his genitals in response to Rubio's jibes about the billionaire's supposedly small hands. "I guarantee you," Trump said, "there's no problem." What the editorial said. "Contrary to what you've heard, the Republican presidential race isn't over," said the Wall Street Journal. Trump's low support among late deciding voters indicates that the recent barrage of attack ads and criticism by party leaders is having an effect. A new Wall Street Journal, NBC News national poll of GOP primary voters found the race tightening, with Trump at 30%, Cruz at 27%, Kasich at 22%, and Rubio with 20%. In addition, the businessman nearly always loses a hypothetical one-on-one matchup with his rivals. "For the first time in four decades, Republicans face the real possibility of a contested convention," said NationalReview.com. "If Trump arrives in Cleveland just shy of the delegate majority he needs, his supporters will cry foul if he isn't nominated, but the process is designed to produce the best candidate for the general election, and the party is free under the rules to choose someone else." "It shouldn't be Rubio," said the Tampa Bay Times. "The smooth-talking senator has always been more talk than action, more gimmick than substance, and the campaign has revealed that he's not prepared to be president. Unless he pulls off a miracle in Florida, his candidacy is finished." What the columnist said. "The Stop Trump movement needs to face reality," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "If Rubio and Kasich drop out to let Cruz go one-on-one with Trump, the evangelical Texas senator will struggle to win in the big northern states that have yet to vote. If all three stay in, they'll need to work together to prevent a Trump majority. But Cruz's decision last week to expand his campaign in Florida shows he won't play ball. Ultimately, nothing will persuade the 35-40% of voters who blindly support Trump to abandon their leader. That will probably be enough to win him the nomination. Either way, the party of Lincoln and Reagan is shattering, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. If anti-Trump forces somehow do deny him the nomination, his supporters will bolt, which will break the party. If, on the other hand, Trump is crowned the head of the GOP in Cleveland on an anti-immigrant, anti-free trade platform, principled conservatives and big donors will be so disgusted they'll leave the party. Even if Trump loses the general election, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com, his nomination will stamp his demagoguery with the party's imprimatur and leave Trump as the face of the GOP brand for years. The GOP, as we know it, does look fated for a crack-up. So what are anti-Trump Republicans to do, asked Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Cruz is also intolerable to most of us, since he's actually moved to the right of Trump on illegal immigration. And as one Republican told me, he seems covered in a thick layer of people repellent. That leaves one alternative. Support a center-right third-party candidate who could preserve the core message of the party until Trump and his vile brand have faded away. A contested convention is a more realistic option, said David Brooks in the New York Times. If Rubio can pull off a comeback in Florida and Kasich wins Ohio, Trump would need nearly 70% of the remaining delegates. He's unlikely to get them. A brokered convention would be bedlam for a few days, but a broadly acceptable new option might emerge. This is a moment for audacity, not resignation, because the future of the Republican Party is at stake. And a second main story, Sanders stages a surprise comeback. What happened? A revitalized Bernie Sanders exploited Hillary Clinton's weakness among white working-class voters this week to win an upset in Michigan's Democratic primary, casting doubt on her viability in upcoming Midwest races. Defying polls that predicted a 20-point Clinton victory, the Vermont senator prevailed 49.8% to 48.3%, buoyed by a 57-41 edge among white voters, offsetting Clinton's 34-point advantage with minorities. Economic issues drove the race. On the stump in the Rust Belt state, Clinton hammered Sanders for his 2009 vote against a government bailout of the auto industry, though he'd actually opposed including the funds in a larger bailout package for Wall Street banks. The self-declared Democratic Socialist, in turn, skewered Clinton's support of free trade agreements such as NAFTA, signed in 1993 by her husband, President Bill Clinton, saying the deals had cost hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. Those attacks struck a chord, with Sanders defeating Clinton by 13 points among voters who believe free trade is bad for U.S. workers. The senator said his Michigan victory proved his promised political revolution was real and strong in every part of the country. While the win gave Sanders renewed hope for next week's primaries in delegate-rich Ohio and Illinois, he faces some daunting math. Clinton romped 83-17 in Mississippi's primary, held the same day as Michigan's, and now has 761 delegates to Sanders' 547. A candidate needs 2,383 delegates to claim the nomination. Add in superdelegates, party leaders who can support a candidate regardless of how their own states vote, and the former Secretary of State's lead swells to 1221 to 571. What the editorial said. Clinton must be stunned by her loss, said the Detroit Free Press. She had a beaucoup institutional support, including both of Michigan's sitting senators, and an overwhelming edge among minorities. But Sanders did surprisingly well with non-white voters, winning 31% of African Americans, about double his share in Southern primaries. by expanding his support beyond white millennials, Sanders has moved closer to winning the nomination. Sanders' one-note campaign glosses over history, said the Dallas Morning News. The senator boasts that, unlike Clinton, he opposed the 2008 Wall Street bailout. But he ignores the horrifying reality that America's financial system was on the brink of collapse. The human toll of any failure would have been staggering, and not just among bankers and billionaires. Then Senator Clinton saw the risks, and with 72 other senators, she acted to avert another depression. Sanders was busy shouting about the unfairness of that system. He still is. What the columnist said. We now know Sanders can win big states outside the South, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. Problem is, he's not showing he can win them by much. That matters because Clinton's landslides in delegate-rich states like Texas and Georgia have rendered Bernie's pickups moot. His Michigan upset helps mostly in terms of horse race narrative purposes, showing the world he's not dead yet. But his populist message could lead to wins in other industrial states, such as Ohio and Pennsylvania, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. That would give him enough delegates to stay in the race and compete in New York in April and California in June. It's unlikely he'd win those primaries, but then nobody thought he'd win Michigan. Clinton shouldn't panic, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. But she should worry. Sanders has exposed two vulnerabilities that could turn off voters in November. Clinton's perceived coziness with Wall Street and her intermittent support of free trade. Against a traditional pro-free trade, pro-big business Republican candidate, that baggage wouldn't be a problem. But the GOP's likely candidate, Donald Trump, has tapped a similar vein of anti-trade, anti-elite sentiment to Sanders, and could force her to focus more on defending states like Michigan. Clinton will have to win back Sanders supporters if she eventually grinds out the nomination, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. That'll be tough. Michigan voters who value honesty, for example, gave Sanders a staggering 80-19 advantage. Eventually, Clinton will need to shore up her left with an endorsement from a respected progressive like Senator Elizabeth Warren, and maybe one from Bernie himself. Should the GOP nominate the xenophobic, racist, misogynistic Trump, Clinton should find it relatively easy to reunify her party for the fall campaign. In the controversy of the week, Trump, could he win the general election? Don't laugh, said Zach Carter in HuffingtonPost.com, but it's starting to look as though Donald Trump could actually win this thing. Not just the Republican nomination, the presidency. Trump's detail-free promises to bring back jobs from China and Mexico and to wall out competition from illegal immigrants are resonating with blue-collar men across the political spectrum. His enormous popularity with the white working class has expanded the Republican vote and gives him a perfectly plausible path to the White House in November. The key is the Rust Belt. Skeptics say Trump's hard line on immigration would cost him states with large Hispanic populations, such as Florida, Nevada, and New Mexico. But he could survive those losses if white working-class males delivered him swing states such as Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If Trump is the GOP nominee, said Stephen Shepard in Politico.com, his unique political brand could result in a crazy quilt general election that could put longtime Democratic strongholds in play. It's simply impossible to predict how that turns out. There aren't enough white men for Trump to win in November, said David Bernstein, also in Politico.com. In 1980, the white male vote was 45% of the overall total. but by 2012 had declined to 35% in a more diverse America. So here's the math. With 61% of female voters already saying they'd choose Hillary Clinton over Trump, and 75% of Hispanic voters holding a very unfavorable opinion of him, Trump would need to win an unprecedented 70% of the white male vote to stand a chance. Given his lack of popularity with younger and more educated whites, that's hard to picture. Trump is viewed negatively by 60% of all voters, the highest negative rating of any presidential candidate Gallup has ever tested, said Virad Mehta in TheFederalist.com. College-educated voters in particular cannot stand Trump. To make up the gap, he may double down on his white identity appeals to the working-class voters, but then he'll alienate even larger percentages of women, minorities, and college grads. The votes just aren't there. The votes may not be there yet, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com, but we haven't yet met the Donald Trump who would be a general election candidate. Trump has demonstrated an uncanny knack for telling voters what they want to hear and a complete lack of shame about changing his positions as circumstances demand. The moment Trump wins the nomination, said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com, he may morph into a starkly different person, with a message designed for the general electorate. That could mean dialing down the dog whistle rhetoric he used so effectively in the primaries and focusing on tax cuts, job creation, and withering attacks on Hillary as an untrustworthy tool of the Washington establishment. Trump can rebrand himself all he wants, said Bill Scheer in RealClearPolitics.com. But it's not going to stop him from getting vastly outspent in the general election. Clinton is expected to raise and spend at least $1.5 billion. Trump, though a multi-billionaire on paper, is thought to have only about $300 million in liquid assets, which he's shown no inclination to spend on his campaign. Most of the usual Republican mega-donors, such as the Koch brothers, are unlikely to fund him. Trump, though, will get plenty of free exposure because he has captivated the news media in ways never seen in politics, said J. Newton Small in Time.com. The fact is that Donald Trump has done nothing but upend conventional wisdom in this election. If it's hard to imagine him winning in November, well, virtually no one saw him getting this far. It was a good week for heads-up play after a quick reacting dad at a spring training baseball game stuck out his arm and saved his smartphone-distracted son from a thrown bat headed straight for his face. There wasn't a lot of time to think, said the dad, Sean Cunningham. It was a good week for Christopher LeCone, a Florida scuba diver who was sucked inside the intake pipe of the St. Lucie nuclear power plant. LeCun figured he was about to be shredded by a turbine, but popped out unharmed into a pool of water used to cool the reactor. "How did you get in here?" an astonished plant worker asked him. And it was a good week for the machines. After Google's AlphaGo computer program trounced the world's best player in a game of Go, a Chinese board game that requires intuitive strategy instead of raw computing power. "I am very surprised," said Li Sedol after his defeat. It was a bad week for Maria Sharapova, who was indefinitely suspended from all tennis tournaments for taking meldonium, a drug that can boost oxygen levels. Sharapova said she'd been taking the drug for a decade for medical reasons and didn't realize it was now banned. It was a bad week for haunting performances after a British man was arrested and fined for harassing mourners in a cemetery, He was throwing himself backwards, waving his arms and going, "Woo," said the prosecutor. I'm assuming he was pretending to be a ghost. And it was a bad week for hood ornaments after an Illinois woman was arrested while driving around with a 15-foot tree lodged in her car's front grill. The driver allegedly told police she didn't remember where she had hit the tree and was charged with DUI. On the briefing page, the Zika epidemic. With the 2016 Rio Olympics looming, researchers are racing to contain a menacing viral outbreak. What is Zika? It's a mosquito-borne virus that has infected hundreds of thousands of people and caused a rapidly spreading epidemic across Central and South America and the Caribbean. Found in the same family as yellow fever, chikungunya, and dengue, Zika was considered a relatively harmless cousin of those viruses until last year, when the explosion of 1 million cases in Brazil was accompanied by an unusual surge in a rare birth defect known as microcephaly. Zika has since spread to more than 30 countries, prompting the World Health Organization to declare a public health emergency. More than 4 million cases are expected in the Western Hemisphere alone this year. With the epidemic moving northward and summer approaching, U.S. officials are waiting for Zika-infected mosquitoes to strike in Florida and other Gulf Coast states. It's like preparing for a hurricane, said Dennis Moore, director of mosquito control in Pasco County, Florida. You know it's coming from across the Gulf, but where it's going to land, we just don't know. Is Zika a new virus? No. It was discovered in 1947 among monkeys in Uganda's Zika forest. But until recently, human outbreaks have been small and infrequent and limited to Africa and Asia. It wasn't until 2014 that the virus crossed over to the Western Hemisphere, hitting Easter Island before hopping to Brazil and then rapidly spreading throughout the Southern Hemisphere. In most cases, Zika is spread by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, a particularly efficient disease carrier that, aided by the warmer and wetter environments provided by climate change, has adapted to live all over the world, including the southeastern U.S. Aedes aegypti is an extremely prolific and resilient foe. Their eggs can literally survive in a bottle cap of water, says public health professor Robert Amler. In the U.S., at least 153 people have contracted Zika, either by being bitten while abroad or through the semen of an infected male sex partner who had returned from an affected region. What are the symptoms? About 80% of sufferers don't experience any symptoms at all and aren't aware they're infected. The rest experience mild symptoms, including fever, muscle and joint aches, conjunctivitis, and a rash. But in a few rare cases, people with Zika go on to suffer serious complications. Scientists recently announced that they had discovered Zika in the blood of 42 people suffering from Guillain-Barré, a potentially fatal neurological condition that can cause paralysis. The links are as strong as they would be for saying that tobacco causes lung cancer, said researcher Dr. Arnaud Fontenay. There are also strong links between Zika and another debilitating neurological condition, microcephaly. What is microcephaly? It's a birth defect characterized by abnormally small heads. In most cases, the baby's brain hasn't properly developed, leading to severe cognitive disorders, intellectual disability, and possibly death. In the first months of the Zika outbreak, the number of reported cases of microcephaly jumped 20-fold in Brazil. doctors, pediatricians, neurologists. They started finding this thing we had never seen, said infectious disease researchers Selena Turchi. Reported cases of microcephaly in Brazil now number 4,222, with 641 confirmed. Scientists believe Zika can spread through a pregnant woman's amniotic fluid and into the brain of a fetus, attacking the neural cells and stunting the baby's brain development. While direct proof that the virus causes the condition has yet to be found, the evidence pointing to that conclusion is growing. A new study found that under laboratory conditions, Zika selectively attacks cells in the brain's cortex or outer layer, interrupting brain growth. What's being done to combat Zika? Affected regions are trying to reduce mosquito populations with stepped-up spraying of insecticides. Meanwhile, at least 15 research groups are trying to develop a vaccine, though clinical trials could be at least 17 months away. President Obama has asked for $1.8 billion in emergency funding from Congress to help speed the vaccine work and fight the Zika epidemic. Pregnant women are also being advised to avoid affected regions, while women living at the center of the epidemic have been told to avoid getting pregnant for up to 2 years, guidance that has sparked a passionate debate about contraception and abortion in the predominantly Roman Catholic region. One other highly controversial option has yet to be implemented. What's that? Mass mosquito genocide. A British company called Oxitec has developed a genetically modified mosquito that could wipe out the Aedes aegypti species by passing on a self-destructive gene that kills the insect's offspring at the larval stage. Labeled the Robo Frankenstein mosquito by its detractors, the GM mosquito successfully wiped out 99% of the target population when it was released into Brazil's streets during a 2011 experiment. Going to the genetic option may become increasingly attractive as air travel and climate change allow dangerous tropical illnesses like West Nile virus and dengue fever to march north to colder climates. But scientists remain divided about whether eliminating mosquitoes is worth the risk of unintended consequences for the ecosystem. "We want to be very careful about this," says mosquito researcher Anthony James. "None of us want to be known for creating some kind of disaster." And we'll read a few of the best columns. The first coming from the U.S., titled "The War Between Cities and States." "A political civil war has broken out between America's cities and its states," said Harold Meyerson. "Today, 27 of the nation's 30 largest cities have Democratic mayors. By contrast, the GOP controls both the governorship and legislature in 23 states. Only 7 states are fully Democratic-controlled. The result? A growing number of jarring public policy collisions. In Birmingham, Alabama, the Democratic City Council recently raised the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. In response, state Republicans enacted a law forbidding cities from setting any wage standards at all. In Arizona, GOP state officials passed draconian anti-immigrant laws, while Democratic-controlled Phoenix directed police not to hand over immigrant detainees to the feds for deportation. Texas cities have adopted a ban on plastic bags, which the state legislature is trying to overturn. More pitched battles of this kind are inevitable, as Republicans increasingly dominate rural regions and an epochal influx of minorities and liberal millennials is turning big cities such as Dallas and Houston blue even in the reddest states. The war between cities and states may be only just beginning. This column comes from Ireland. Rewarding those who fail to pay. What a sucker I was for paying my water bill, said Adrian Weckler. Over the past few years, I've paid hundreds of euros to Irish Water, the wildly unpopular utility established in 2013 to centralize and upgrade water services. Until Irish Water was created, water was provided free through the national budget. Hundreds of thousands of my countrymen refused to pay the new charges, and now they may just get away with it. In last week's election, many of the parties that support scrapping Irish Water did well and will probably form the next government. The two largest, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, say they won't penalize those who shredded their bills, while customers who did pay up won't get any refund or tax credit. We law-abiders are left feeling like saps, while the scoff laws gleefully mock our squareness. I'm starting to wonder what other taxes I'm being foolish in paying. Property tax? TV license? The precedent the incoming government is setting could undermine the very idea of Irish governance. Don't pay now, we'll tell each other. Wait it out. Let your neighbor pay your share. What a sorry civics lesson we have all learned, and from the very parties that were supposed to embody fiscal prudence. And this last column from Nigeria. Children die for lack of toilets. Tens of thousands of Nigerian children die every year because this country lacks basic sanitation, said This Day. It's not just that rural areas have no indoor plumbing. They don't even dig latrines. The country is one huge field where people defecate without shame and without taking into consideration the impact of their actions on the health of others. Some go in creeks and rivers, polluting the water we all depend on. Even in our so-called modern cities, people defecate outdoors, and walkways and bushes reek with the stench of urine and fecal matter. This filth is spread microscopically by flies and dust, so it's nearly impossible to avoid ingesting human waste, even if you yourself have a decent toilet. The result is that diarrheal disease is endemic, especially among children, 85,000 of whom die every year from typhoid fever, dysentery, and other conditions. That makes this scourge more of a threat to us all than Boko Haram or any terrorist group. The scarcity of toilets also puts girls and women at risk of sexual violence when they can't find places to relieve themselves in private. Nigeria has the resources to bring plumbing to the people and to educate them on its importance. What it has so far lacked is the will. And now the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Relics from the Kitchen Counter. A small group of collectors scours eBay for rare, decades-old boxes of Captain Crunch and Wheaties. Writer Whitney Falloon looks at what drives them to pay thousands of dollars for cardboard collectibles. Dwayne Dimmock once paid $450 for a box of cereal. But this wasn't the makings of a week of very expensive breakfasts. Rather, it was the box itself that he was after. Dimmock belongs to a small niche group of hobbyists who collect cereal boxes, and in their world, $450 doesn't raise many eyebrows. Last summer, an unopened package of Post 10, the now-defunct variety pack of mini cereal boxes, dating back to 1961, sold for a whopping $2,550 on eBay. Just a few weeks ago, a box of Quaker Quisp from the same era fetched over $2,100. What fuels people to drop the equivalent of 6 months of groceries on a single box of cereal? To answer that question, one must first get familiar with breakfast cereal's trajectory from a lowly morning meal to an American pop culture icon. Descended from its early ancestor, porridge, the first cold breakfast cereal was invented in the U.S. in the 1860s. Called granola, it never quite captured the hearts of American consumers due to a lack of convenience. The nuggets had to be soaked overnight in milk before they could be consumed without chipping a tooth. It probably wasn't too tasty either, as it only had two ingredients, graham flour and water. It took a young doctor from Battle Creek, Michigan, named John Harvey Kellogg, to take cereal fully mainstream. His lighter, crispier cornflakes, originally created to feed sanitarium patients, were practically an overnight success, and by the early 1900s, dozens of cereal companies, including fellow heavy hitter Post, had popped up in Battle Creek. It wasn't until after World War II that cereal companies began targeting kids. In 1948, Post introduced its first sugar-coated cereal, Sugar Crisp, along with an animated TV commercial, and its competitors quickly followed suit. In 1951, Kellogg's unveiled its feline mascot, Tony the Tiger, who convinced kids all over the nation how great the company's Frosted Flakes were. Sweetened cereals came to dominate the market, bolstered by product placement in cartoon shows that helped manufacturers hook an entire generation of children, and by extension, their future children and grandchildren. Like collectors of many other breeds, from baseball cards to pinball machines, cereal box aficionados are fueled largely by nostalgia. I have vivid memories of sitting around on Saturday mornings watching cartoons with a bowl of Cap'n Crunch or Fruity Pebbles in front of me, said Gabe Fonseca, a television writer from L.A., who's been collecting cereal boxes for a decade. Like many others, he fell into the hobby mostly by accident when an eBay search for something unrelated brought up a 1995 box of Spider-Man cereal, one of his childhood favorites. It was cheap, so I thought, what the heck, why not, and bought it. Things snowballed from there, and Fonseca has now amassed more than 300 cereal boxes. For DeMock, the cereal box fixation began more than 40 years ago when he began stashing away unopened premiums. That's collector speak for the prizes that came inside cereal boxes, in hopes they'd be valuable someday. As it turns out, it's the boxes themselves, rather than the premiums, that are typically worth more cash, because, as Dimmock explains, fewer of them survived intact. The cereal box's innately disposable nature seems to be one of the things that attracts collectors. Unlike, say, baseball cards, they were never intended to be saved. They're also colorful and easy to display, which certainly doesn't hurt. After all, people who purchase Fruit Loops do so strictly in pursuit of the sugary little O's inside. As soon as those are gone, the packaging is discarded and carted off to a landfill, or with any luck, a recycling facility. One of DeMock's most prized specimens in his collection of an estimated 10,000 boxes is an original Kellogg's Corn Flakes box from 1906, which only survived for decades. It had been because it had been used as padding for the back of a picture frame. But in the cereal box world, the oldest boxes aren't necessarily the most valuable. Case in point, Dimmock once purchased a box of Granum, an early wheat cereal product marketed as the best food for invalids and convalescents, dating back to 1869 for the paltry sum of $34 on eBay. As Fonseca explains, the value of any particular cereal box is highly subjective. Boxes are only as valuable as what someone else is willing to pay, he points out. As the collectibles booms of the 90s took hold, hello Beanie Babies, and more people became aware of the potential value of cereal boxes, they began stashing them away accordingly. It seems highly unlikely that the cereal hobby will ever be large enough to absorb that glut of 1990s boxes, a New York City-based collector named John Liebig argues on a popular cereal box collectors forum called Cereal Bits. Once books are written about a hobby, things change. But some boxes will still shine through, of course. The most desirable boxes, then, are the ones with widest appeal. Boxes emblazoned with popular cartoon characters, sports stars, or musicians, and those featuring a mail-in offer that could be sent off for some sort of limited edition prize. Think Dakota rings or toy Navy boats. Often the cereal box market intersects with other popular collectible categories. One of Fonseca's most prized items is a box of New Kids on the Block cereal from a brief test run in 1990. It never actually made it into production, making it extremely rare. A pair of boxes of Nabisco wheat honeys and rice honeys from the late 1960s with a Beatles Yellow Submarine tie-in recently popped up on eBay for an astronomical $11,000. Superhero-themed boxes are also wildly popular. But while nostalgia may be universal, the cereal box collecting community is remarkably small. Liebig, who also runs a site called CollectingCandy.com, estimates there may only be a few dozen active collectors out there today. Cereal Bits, the most popular online discussion forum for hobbyists, has just 97 active members. But many of those are crossover collectors like Star Wars obsessives who collect the various limited edition Star Wars cereals, or sports memorabilia lovers who collect Wheaties boxes. In the pre-internet era, collectors mainly found one another via various fanzines, such as the one from the collector named McCall Vollmer called Free Inside that launched in 1988. These days, zines have been replaced by YouTube channels, and collectors congregate almost entirely online, in Facebook groups and discussion forums like Cereal Bits, where they post tales of triumph, like finally completing a set of 1964 pirate-themed Cap'n Crunch premiums, and report on trends, such as the fact that Wheaties boxes from the 1970s featuring Olympic athlete Bruce Jenner are now fetching record prices. Fonseca, for his part, hosts a surprisingly captivating YouTube series called Cereal Time, in which he discusses cereals both new and old, including many coveted finds from the era in which he grew up, the 80s and 90s, such as Urkel O's, C-3PO's, and Ghostbusters cereal. As his more than 2,000 YouTube subscribers prove, you don't have to be a hardcore collector to be enthralled by Fonseca's videos. Even people who find this hobby strange, and there are many, still enjoy looking at the boxes and reminiscing about a particular cereal they used to eat. According to Liebig, the online community, no matter how small, has changed the collecting game. I believe that in the post-eBay and post-social media world, the importance of face-to-face meetups has evaporated. Whereas in the past, they were key to building a collection, he says. Before online auctions and discussion forums, tracking down a rare cereal box could require months or even years of following leads from other collectors and traveling to in-person swap meets. Nowadays, it can be as easy as a simple eBay search and plunking down some cold hard cash. But even with the internet at their fingertips, not all collectors are able to satisfy their ultimate cereal box wish list. The elusive specimen that keeps Liebig up at night is a box of Super Sugar Crisp circa 1975 that came with an 11 by 14 inch glow-in-the-dark poster of Frankenstein inside. That's one I remember so well from when I was a kid, but it's one I'm not likely to ever find or add to my collection, he says, noting that to his knowledge, only two have ever surfaced. for Fonseca. His white whale was literally a whale. For years, I had been trying to find a box of Lucky Charms that came out around 1986 with swirled whale marshmallows, he explained. I found commercials on YouTube for it and pictures online, so I knew I wasn't imagining the box, but I could never track one down. He eventually tracked down a collector via an online forum who is willing to part with his and says these days he feels like his collection is more or less complete. But for others, like Demok, the thrill of the hunt is their biggest draw. The near infinite variety of cereal boxes, along with the scarce supply, is what keeps many collectors enthralled. Despite already owning a veritable cereal box museum, including a prize set of Captain Christmas Crunch boxes stretching back to 1988, he knows there are plenty more boxes out there in the world just waiting to be discovered. Nobody wants to stop collecting, he says. They just want to keep going. This was originally published in Eater.com, which is owned by Vox Media. And one of the obituaries for you this week. The first lady who always protected her Ronnie. Nancy Reagan, 1921 to 2016. When Nancy Davis married Ronald Reagan, she never anticipated becoming the First Lady of the United States. "I thought I married an actor," she said. But the former actress went on to become one of the most influential presidential wives in history, and one of the most devoted. Fiercely protective of her Ronnie, she was instrumental in everything from his softened stance on the Soviet Union to the hiring and firing of key staffers and cabinet members. Reagan's single-minded focus on her husband, who called her Mommy, won her few friends. Staffers called her the Dragon Lady, and reporters mocked the reverential, wide-eyed way she looked at the president as the gaze. Even the couple's children said they felt like outsiders in their own family. But while Reagan said she regretted alienating her son and daughter, she was otherwise unapologetic. "Did I ever give Ronnie advice?" "You bet," she said. "I'm the one who knows him best, and I was the only person in the White House who had absolutely no agenda of her own except helping him." Reagan was born Ann Frances Robbins in New York City, but was always known as Nancy, said CNN.com. Her parents, a stage actress and a car salesman, divorced when she was seven. When her mother later married Chicago neurosurgeon Loyal Davis, Nancy took her stepfather's name. She fell in love with acting at school and after college used her mother's contacts in Hollywood to land a film contract with MGM. She starred in several small movies, but her career almost ended before it began when her name erroneously appeared on a list of suspected communist sympathizers. To rectify the error, a friend arranged for her to meet the president of the Screen Actors Guild, a dashing leading man named Ronald Reagan. 2 years later, in 1952, they married. "My life," she said, "didn't really begin until I met Ronnie." Reagan planned to quit working after giving birth to a daughter, Patty, but she continued to accept roles because her husband's acting career was in decline, said the Los Angeles Times. In 1957, the couple starred opposite each other in a World War II movie, Hellcats of the Navy. Reagan launched his political career after gaining national attention in 1964 with a televised speech endorsing Barry Goldwater for president. 2 years later, the actor successfully ran for the California governorship. For Nancy, who had helped run his election campaign, it was the start of a bruising political education. She was branded a snob in Sacramento for choosing to live in a grand suburban property leased from wealthy friends, rather than in the governor's mansion. The tone of press coverage was set up set by a deeply unflattering 1968 profile by Joan Didion in the Saturday Evening Post, which described Reagan's smile as a study in frozen insincerity. From then on, Reagan's good deeds in California, in particular her lavish dinners welcoming home prisoners of war from Vietnam, were barely noticed. When Reagan won the presidency in 1980, Washington initially seemed to embrace the glamorous first couple, said the Washington Post. But with the economy struggling, the glamour soon was seen as ostentation. The First Lady was hammered for spending $800,000 on redecorating the White House and $200,000 on new china, even though all the money had come from private donations. It also emerged that Queen Nancy had been accepting expensive jewelry and gifts from fashion designers. In an attempt to deflect the criticism, Reagan donned a bag lady costume and sang Secondhand Clothes, a parody of the song Secondhand Rose, at the 1982 Gridiron Dinner in Washington. Her self-deprecating performance brought down the house and earned her a reprieve from her critics. Reagan's darkest memory was of March 30, 1981, when she received word that her husband had been shot by a would-be assassin, said the New York Times. "Nothing can happen to my Ronnie," she wrote in her diary that night. "My life would be over." During his recovery, the First Lady sought guidance from Joan Quigley, a San Francisco astrologer who claimed she had predicted the March 30th would be a bad day for the president. Within a year, Reagan was regularly consulting Quigley about which days were supposedly favorable and unfavorable, and having the president's staff arrange his schedule accordingly. Her astrological bent was exposed in a 1988 memoir by former White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan, whose firing over the Iran-Contra affair she had encouraged. The First Lady later admitted that consulting Quigley had been a terrible mistake. "During their 8 years in the White House, the Reagans made a good political team," said Politico.com. "While he was easygoing, she was energetic and direct. The First Lady exerted her influence through her controversial Just Say No anti-drug campaign, for which she organized two international conferences, and through hands-on management of White House staff. She favored anyone who was loyal to her husband, but sought to drive out all those she suspected of mixed agendas. In a 1988 interview, she insisted she had intervened only because the president had been so badly served by his top aides. Reagan's role as her husband's gatekeeper intensified after he left office," said Slate.com. "When doctors told her that he had Alzheimer's disease, she kept the news from him for a number of years until 1994. From that point until his death, 10 years later, Reagan cared for him behind a veil at their mansion in Los Angeles. She broke with President George W. Bush and Republicans and became a vocal advocate for using federal funding for embryonic stem cell research into treatment for Alzheimer's and other conditions. Ultimately, Reagan never really got over the death of her beloved Ronnie. There are people who told me it gets much easier," she said in 2007. "Well, maybe for them, but not for me. I miss him more now than I ever did." On the health and science page, the gray hair gene. People usually attribute graying hair to the effects of aging and stress. Think of all those before and after photos of U.S. presidents. But a new study shows that we can also blame our DNA. Researchers at University College London have pinpointed a gray hair gene, suggesting that some people are born with an inherited tendency to go gray before their time. The team analyzed the hair types and genomes of more than 6,000 people of mixed ethnic ancestry from 5 Latin American countries to find the gene, which is known as IRF4 and is carried by about 15% of Europeans. Also linked to blonde hair, IRF4 regulates the production and storage of melanin, the pigment that gives eyes, skin, and hair their color. We already know several genes involved in balding and hair color, but this is the first time a gene for graying has been identified in humans. Lead author Kaustubh Adhikari tells TechTimes.com, the researchers estimate the gene is responsible for about 30% of graying. More research into how IRF4 works could lead to treatments that help delay or reverse this process. Standard hair products are applied after your hair has been created, Adhikari says, but targeting the hair as it is being produced could result in greater consistency of color or longer-lasting effects. And we just have time for a few short pieces. Let's see. Unplanned pregnancies in the U.S. are at a 30-year low, having fallen 18% between 2008 and 2011, according to the Guttmacher Institute. The drop has occurred in part because of long-acting reversible contraceptives like intrauterine devices and implants, the use of which has tripled since 2007. Presidential hopefuls Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders were the two most partisan members of the U.S. Senate in 2015. Of all the remaining presidential candidates currently serving as senator, Marco Rubio was ranked the most bipartisan, coming 28th out of 100. On the poll watch, 55% of Americans would never consider voting for Donald Trump in a general election, 46% would never vote for Ted Cruz, and 39% would never vote for Marco Rubio. 47% would never vote for Hillary Clinton. And to finish with a quote, this from George Orwell, power worship blurs political judgment. Whoever is winning at the moment will always seem to be invincible. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.